From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Pfizer says it plans to apply for emergency use authorization of its COVID-19 vaccine within days. The company says the vaccine is 95% effective, and that's higher than previously reported, though this updated analysis and data has not been peer-reviewed. Pfizer also says the vaccine has no serious side effects.
All welcome news, as Indiana and Wisconsin reported single-day case records yesterday, and more than 248,000 people have now died from the virus in the United States. Let's bring in Dr. Michael Osterholm. He's advising President-elect Biden on the pandemic and is director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Dr. Osterholm, welcome back.
Thank you.
And before we get to the vaccine news, you made news recently when you said that you thought shutdowns with government monies to help individuals and businesses get through a 4 to 6 week shutdown would greatly flatten this curve, this surge we're now in. Now, can you clear up what you meant? Because some headlines read you were calling for lockdowns, and we think, you know, of lockdowns, we think of China and Italy. People couldn't even leave their homes. You said shutdowns. What did you mean?
I was discussing an op-ed piece that I had co-authored with Neil Kashkari and the president of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank back in the New York Times in August, which made the case that, in fact, what's happening right now would happen, and that we were going to have to find a way to basically crush the virus, but with the idea that we needed to provide financial support to local and state governments, to the private sector, if we're going to do this. I've made the case over and over again, as you're seeing right now, widespread recommendations and enforcement of closing bars and restaurants. Well, if you're going to do that, I believe very much that we owe it to those bar and restaurant owners who are hanging on by a thread as small businesses in many cases. We have to help them out to do the right thing. They want to do the right thing. At the same time, how many, you know, waitresses, single moms with two kids who are just trying to put food on the table and keep a roof over their head, we need to support them. So that was the point I was making.
Well, and so you were talking about, as you said, what is happening? There's targeted stay-at-homes. There's targeted shutdowns of, let's say, bars. And you are saying that there should be monies available. And as we know, there's a bill tied up in Congress that would do just that. What about other mitigations? We spoke to Kinza Thermometer yesterday. They're tracking fevers. They said that the outbreaks they see could be squashed if people just wore masks and, you know, applied social distancing. It seems, though, that the Biden administration, which you're advising, is going to have a huge challenge here. How much damage has the Trump administration done, frankly, to public faith in health officials like yourself? There's a swath of the country that thinks it's a hoax and doesn't believe in masks.
Well, in fact, we really have three things going on right now that are kind of a perfect storm for why we are seeing what we're seeing. And these numbers are going to increase substantially over the days ahead if we don't change course. The first thing is we just have pandemic fatigue. These are people who believe the pandemic is real. They want to do something about it, but they're now into their 10th month of dealing with this. Just remind everyone, in 1918, when we had this terrible influenza pandemic, it lasted on average 6 to 10 weeks in cities around the country. So you didn't have time to get fatigued. The second thing is happening is pandemic anger. Those who you just indicated believe that this whole pandemic's a hoax, and it basically has political motivation, which by many of their descriptions would have ended after the election. It hasn't. And then the third thing that really brings it, ties it all together, is indoor air. We are now experiencing, with the seasonal change, a much, much higher level of potential contamination in our worlds. And so the combination of those three have made it very difficult to get people to change behaviors that are, in fact, contributing mightily to these increasing cases.
And not only are you saying change these behaviors while we wait for the vaccines, we're going to have some of these mitigating behaviors even when the vaccines come.
Right. I think the really important message here is we do have light at the end of the tunnel. Please hold out. I think that the news on the current status of the vaccines is very exciting. Clearly, they're not going to be here overnight, but they're coming. And so I would rather see us all achieve protection through a vaccine than having to have another 20, 30 or 40% of us get infected and thousands of people die. So my message is one of hope, too. As bad as it is right now, We just have to, you know, hunker down. We've got to get through this period, and then we have the option for vaccines.
And just very briefly, again, one of the advisors to President-elect Biden, what is he not getting because this transition hasn't yet been made, his win hasn't been acknowledged? What, in your view, does he need to get that he's not getting to help in the fight against coronavirus? What do you need as an advisor that you're not getting?
Well, first of all, I won't speak obviously for the campaign. The transition team is working on this every day. I think it is a real challenge not being able to speak to our colleagues in the federal government. There is a tremendous amount of expertise there. My concern right now is, as much as I give great credit to these scientists and to the administration to bring Operation Warp Speed vaccines to us, as they have, a vaccine is just that. It doesn't mean anything till it's a vaccination. And so this last mile of actually delivering the vaccines, convincing the public that they should take the vaccine and do that quickly, is a real challenge before us.
By the way, before we let you go, with the transition not able to happen right now, are you allowed to talk to Dr. Anthony Fauci, who is in, of course, an agency in the government?
At this point, as a member of the task force, I am not having any communications with anyone in the federal government.
Dr. Michael Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, also advising President-elect Biden's pandemic task force. Michael, Dr. Osterholm, thank you.
Thank you.
In northeastern Alaska sits 19 million acres of pristine wilderness, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And beginning this week, oil and gas companies can pick which parts of the refuge's coastal plain they're interested in drilling. The Trump administration made the decision to open up this possibility just before President-elect Joe Biden takes office. And this option to allow drilling is a controversial move. For four decades, this refuge was protected from development. Tegan Hanlon is a reporter for Alaska's Public Media and joins us from Anchorage. Hi, Tegan.
Hi, Tanya. Thanks for having me.
Yes. So give us a sense of the timeline here for a company to secure a lease to drill before Trump leaves office.
So as you mentioned, on Tuesday, this 30-day call for nominations started. And it's basically when oil and gas companies can tell the government which tracts of land in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge's coastal plain they think should be auctioned off in a lease sale. And it's like the last big step before the actual sale of leases. So we don't know for sure the date of a lease sale yet, but we do know that the government has to announce the date at least 30 days in advance of the actual sale. So there could be a lease sale in January, and it could be just days before Joe Biden takes office.
Just days before he takes office on January 20th, and we know that he opposes drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. If leases are sold before he takes office, is there anything his administration can actually do to stop oil and gas companies from drilling there?
That's a good question. So my understanding is there's a few things. The leases would be subject to review, and that process could potentially take months, and the federal agencies could, you know, reject the leases. But if they don't and the leases are issued, it's like a contract between the government and the company who bought the lease. So that's challenging to reverse. But, you know, we've talked to some industry observers up here, and they speculate that the Biden administration could intervene during the permitting process. So these companies that hold the leases have to acquire a series of permits for everything from building a gravel pad to building a ice road. And so, you know, these industry observers had said that the Biden administration could make that permitting process so onerous and challenging that companies decide not to move forward. I wanted to note that this is kind of all happening with this federal law in the background that stems from 2017. So after this, you know, long battle over whether to drill in the coastal plain, the Congress, led by Republicans, passed the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that included a provision to open the refuge to drilling, and it required the government to hold its first ever lease sale in the coastal plain by the end of next year and a second one by the end of 2024. So, you know, even if a lease sale doesn't happen in the next couple of months, that law still exists when Biden takes office, but of course it could be changed.
That's right. And I wanted to ask you, who supports it and who opposes it there in Alaska?
Right. So Alaska's all Republican congressional delegation has long pushed for opening up the coastal plain to drilling. The oil and gas industry trade groups also welcomed this news that, a lease sale could be imminent. And then on the other side, you have environmental organizations who strongly oppose development in the refuge and who have already filed lawsuits in court. When we talk about other Alaskans, there's certainly Alaskans who support oil and gas development in the coastal plain as a way to more jobs, more revenue, good for the economy, and say drilling can happen responsibly. And there's also other Alaskans who say that definitely can't happen. It'll cause irreparable harm to land, climate, animals. And those opposed include the Gwich'in, which is an indigenous group whose members harvest caribou that give birth in the refuge, and they've been a vocal opponent.
Tegan Hanlon is a reporter for Alaska's Public Media. Tegan, thank you so much for this update.
Thank you.
We often say we wish more of us could see what frontline workers in the war against COVID-19 see. People gasping to breathe, lungs shutting down. Maybe more people would understand how serious COVID-19 can be. But maybe we can hear from someone who's been there. 50-year-old Thomas Steele was healthy, no pre-existing conditions, and working in sales in New Braunfels, Texas, when he contracted COVID-19. He didn't worry much about it. Then it got bad. He was hospitalized in San Antonio. Then it got really bad. He was placed on an ECMO machine, a last-ditch treatment that does the job of a patient's heart or lungs, moving blood and oxygen when their own organs are too weak. He was tethered to that machine for 2 months, and still his condition worsened. His lungs deteriorated so severely that he was transferred to Houston Methodist Hospital, where under the care of Dr. Thomas McGilvery, he got a double lung transplant. Despite all of that, we'll call Thomas Steele one of the lucky ones, because unlike more than 248,000 others, he's alive to tell us. Well, let's listen. He joins us from his rehab facility in Texas. Thomas Steele, welcome.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
How are you feeling?
Doing good. Getting stronger every day as far as that goes. I'm about a month out on the surgery, so getting stronger every day.
And here's your surgeon, Thomas McGilvery. Dr. McGilvery, this is good news for you.
Oh, it's just really a privilege to be part of it. In all of this terrible pandemic, which has been a scourge to the whole world, Mr. Steele's story is one that we can all be joyful about. It's a real victory over this terrible disease.
Yeah, well, and then you in the hospitals, and we want to get more of what you're seeing in a moment. But Thomas, how did you view the pandemic before you were infected? We know you work in sales at a construction company. You're married, Rhonda, parents of 5 children, 4 still living. What was your sense? Were you wearing a mask? Were you taking precautions?
I was wearing a mask each month after it broke out. We got a lot more cautious as far as that goes. Yeah, definitely wearing a mask. My wife, she would harp me all the time about washing my hands and trying to get all that stuff good. Wasn't going out very much. Me and her were very big wine and foodies and stuff, so we like to go to restaurants and vineyards and stuff, but we'd really slacked that all back a lot. I can say I wasn't convinced myself how serious this was. Not seeing it firsthand, wasn't sold on it as well.
You're good to admit that, because as you know, there are a lot of people who just are like skeptical about this, and so you had a little of that too. And then there was an office outbreak. You got it, probably gave it to Rhonda. She, it sounds like, had a mild case. What were you feeling as you realized, I'm sick?
Well, originally I went and got a negative test because I went too quickly. And then 2 to 3 days later, I went back. So I was having a little shortness of breath and stuff. And they sent me home. And sitting at home, my daughter, who's studying to be a doctor, she had recommended this little O2 sensor.
This is a pulse oximeter. It's such a great thing to have around the house. You measure how much oxygen you're getting.
And I would suggest everybody get one of them. People don't realize it stuff, but it tells you a lot really quick.
And what it told you is you were not getting enough oxygen. Could you feel that?
I was getting shortness of breath, almost like somebody was sitting on my chest. And so then I was checking this thing, and I went from 88s to 84s to 85, and I kept getting worse. So I immediately called back to the ER and asked them, and they said, well, if it's that low, you need to come in right now. So Then I went back to the hospital, and they immediately said that I needed to go to San Antonio to a bigger hospital, and I should get on ECMO pretty quick.
Right. We've been warned over and over. As you said, you had a little skepticism, but you heard how bad it was. Were you thinking this can't be happening? I mean, what were you thinking?
Oh, yeah, because you think everybody at work that had it for the 2 weeks, my wife had it for 2 weeks, like you said, you're thinking, why did this happen to me like this?
Yeah. Can you describe how bad it got not being able to breathe?
You pretty much are gasping for every breath, and you're thinking about every breath. And every breath you take, you feel like a little clicking back to your throat because you're just taking so much oxygen in and stuff. And it's just you're always just like gasping. You're sucking for air.
It must be so frightening.
You know, you have to fight through it and stuff. And I use my kids, my grandkids as motivation, and my beautiful wife. And it's a fight. It is a very, very big fight. And that's what I like to tell everybody, you know, open their eyes. This is a real thing. This is not a joke.
Dr. McGilvary, I'm going to bring you in. We know your hospital was hard hit with coronavirus cases. We spoke with CEO Mark Boom, who's also a physician, to your colleague Faisal Masood, who told us about the neurological issues he's seeing. And here, lungs. I mean, how bad were Thomas Steele's lungs?
Well, they were totally destroyed. Actually, looking at Mr. Steele's lungs, and while we were doing his transplants, they were devastated and destroyed by the effects of the virus.
Why? Can you just briefly explain, like, why would a virus do that?
Well, viruses are nasty little things. They get inside our cells, and they turn our own cells against our cells. And then it's a war that takes place between the virus and our own body. And the body unleashes the full effect of our immune system in an attempt to neutralize and kill the virus. But what happens in some people is that the immune system, in an effort of trying to destroy the virus, destroys our own lungs or other organs.
It's friendly fire.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we understand Thomas isn't alone. I feel I've seen other stories of single and double lung transplants.
The numbers are starting to add up, but I do think that most people who have the kind of damage to the lungs that Mr. Steele had, they don't survive it. But through part miracle, part of just incredible physical and mental and spiritual strength on Mr. Steele's part, he was able to survive it and prevail through it. And then we were fortunate to get a set of lungs offered for him at the right time and got his transplant done very well.
Well, Thomas Steele, I want to bring you back in because, you know, you are lucky in so many ways, including someone else gave this gift, someone who passed. Could you think about that?
Oh, yeah, believe me, it weighs on your mind there, too. So you got this gift of life because somebody had to give life away or get life taken away from them. And that's one thing I would also, one of my preaches now is also organ donors and stuff, because I would never be here unless somebody decided to donate their organs. I think about their family because, you know, again, it's holiday season and, you know, they're having to be without their loved one as far as that goes. I feel for them as far as that goes.
Well, you know, somebody gave you the gift of breath, you know, the gift of life.
Right, definitely.
And so now you sound like you really want to pass something on here. What do you want to say? We're hearing people are dying in hospitals in South Dakota, and their last words are, this is a hoax. There is no COVID-19. Their last dying words, because they don't believe. And we have Thanksgiving coming up, the holidays. People are thinking, well, what's, you know, get together once. What do you want to say to people?
And that's what I'd say is just be smart. This is a real thing. This is something you don't want to play with. Take it for somebody who's been in the hospital for over 3 months, you know, it's nothing you want to do. You're nothing you want to go through. I can remember fighting for every breath of air for a couple of weeks period there where you're just gasping for every breath. It's not a joke. It's nothing to play with. It's real and it's serious. And back what you were saying on Thanksgiving, that'd be one of the things that people should be more conscious on this. And when you're having these meetings, you're not only dealing with yourself, you're dealing with children, you're dealing with elderly people that could not do so well with it as far as it goes. So you just don't know who's going to give what to who and when, you know?
Yeah. thank you so much for taking the time to say that. I know you're still recovering. You know, I mean, I'm taking a deep breath while I speak to you because what a horror not to be able to breathe. And so thank you so much.
Robin, may I just add, as I listened to Mr. Steele tell his story, there's a couple of things that I take away from it. One is, as a community and as a society, we're all interconnected, and that things like wearing a mask protects ourselves and helps us protect each other. And it's really a small sacrifice to make to keep everybody as safe as we possibly can. It's something that we can do that's positive to help.
Yeah. Dr. Thomas McGilvery, a transplant surgeon at Houston Methodist Hospital, who did the lung transplant, double lung transplant for Thomas Steele, a 50-year-old Texan recovering after contracting COVID-19 this summer. I want to thank you both so much for, we need to hear. We need to hear. And thank you. Thank you so much for telling us. Thomas, thank you so much.
Yes, ma'am.
And best to you.
Yes, ma'am. And same to you.
Well, thanks, Robin, for bringing this story to light. And Mr. Steele, I tell you, it's great to hear your voice. You're a remarkable person.
I appreciate that. And
I could tell when I first laid eyes on you, I knew you were a special guy. You have a remarkable family, and I couldn't be happier for you and your whole family.
Thank you so much. I was going to let you know, I think they gave me a release date, I think, of next Monday.
Yeah. But watching you get better is like it's what keeps the rest of us coming to work every day. It truly is.
I appreciate everything you've done for me on it. I'm blessed by God, and thankful and so much everything Houston Methodist has done for me and y'all have done for me. And again, as bad as experience it is, y'all made it where it's a lot easier.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. A resilient city and region relies on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve Greater Boston's most serious problems, from the hardships of COVID to the fight for racial equity and other important issues that affect the lives of everyone in our community. Learn how you can help build a Greater Boston that works for everyone by partnering with the Boston Foundation at tbf.org/partner.
Let's get back to that good news on the COVID-19 front about vaccines. Drug maker Pfizer and the German company BioNTech announced that theirs is 95% effective in preventing cases of COVID-19 over the 90% that had already been reported. And matching the news 2 days ago from drug maker Moderna, revealing that their vaccine is more than 94% effective. And at a summit held by STAT, the health and medicine publication, Anthony Fauci said millions of Americans could be vaccinated by the end of this year. Let's bring in Helen Branswell from our partners at STAT. And Helen, talk first about the Pfizer announcement. What does this mean, 95% effective?
Well, these are extraordinary outcomes. Both the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines seem to be highly protective, at least in the short term. I was talking with Dr. Fauci earlier this week about the Moderna results, and he admitted that he had not been anticipating such good responses.
Right. So it means basically not a lot of people developed symptoms from the vaccination, or the people who had it as opposed to those who had the placebo had far greater success in not coming down with an infection. But what questions still remain about distribution?
One of the things we don't know is whether or not this blocks symptoms or blocks infection. And that's important because if people who are vaccinated can still become infected, they may be protected, but they may also still be able to transmit virus, which could have an impact on, of course, people in the community who are not yet vaccinated.
Tell us more about what Dr. Fauci said about how many people, might be receiving this vaccine. We're reading and reporting from STAT that maybe up to 20 million by the end of this year.
Pfizer expects to have enough vaccine available for the United States that 20 million people could be vaccinated within that time frame. Whether or not that many people are vaccinated by the end of the year remains to be seen. It depends on how efficiently the distribution process works. But yes, as long as the FDA approves this vaccine, and it would seem that they probably will, and that vaccine can be sort of pushed out and into arms.
Both the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines have the same technique. They trick the body into producing coronavirus antibodies so it can fight off infection. But the Pfizer needs to be at, you know, I think minus 100 degree refrigeration. And we understand Pfizer has built a box which they're testing out to try to distribute their vaccine. Talk a little more about the distribution questions.
Right. So these two vaccines look really good so far, but it is true that among the various COVID vaccines that are probably going to be put into use, these two are the hardest to administer, and the Pfizer in particular. It needs to be kept, as you said, at minus 90 degrees Celsius or a little lower even. It requires ultra-cold freezers. So yes, the company has built these special distribution packs that can hold up to 5,000 doses of vaccine, I believe. They can be opened only twice a day for a minute at a time to make sure that the vaccine doesn't warm up too quickly. This is not something that will be available immediately in your local pharmacy or even at a local doctor's office. Hmm.
Helen Branswell, with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine Publication, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
A census survey finds nearly 10 million homeowners as of late October are already behind on their mortgage payments. And the Aspen Institute estimates 30 to 40 million renters in the United States are at risk of eviction. The pandemic has exacerbated the country's ongoing housing crisis. And with federal protections expiring at the end of the year, it's an urgent crisis the incoming Biden-Harris administration will inherit in the new year. Diane Yentl is the CEO and president of the National Low Income Housing Coalition, and her name has been floated as a possible HUD secretary, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yes, so the Center for Disease Control eviction moratoriums are set to expire on December 31st, as do many of the remaining federal unemployment benefits. Your organization is organizing for a call to action tomorrow for rent relief. What exactly do you feel Congress needs to do?
Right. Well, yeah, the situation is very dire. We are facing the possibility of tens of millions of renters losing their homes this winter when the eviction moratorium expires on December 31st. And at that point, renters will owe an estimated range of $25 billion to $70 billion in back rent, which is obviously far more than they can possibly pay off. And at that point, there will be virtually no remaining protections to keep them housed. And, you know, the consequences of tens of millions of people, predominantly people of color, people with very low incomes, losing their homes in the dead of winter during a spike in COVID-19, it would be catastrophic for families, for children, for communities, certainly for our country's effort to contain the pandemic. But the thing about the eviction crisis that we're facing is that not only is it entirely predictable, as we and others have been predicting it for over 8 months, it's completely preventable. But preventing it requires the Congress and the White House act to implement new protections, provide new resources. So we are calling on Congress to, one, establish a broad moratorium on all evictions for non-payment of rent. You know, the very least the federal government ought to do in the middle of a public health emergency is assure each of us that we're not going to lose our homes in the middle of it. But moratoriums on their own aren't enough because eventually they do expire. They create a financial cliff that renters can fall off of when back rent is owed. So we are also pushing for Congress to provide at least $100 billion in emergency rental assistance to keep those renters stably housed during the pandemic, to make sure that small landlords receive the rental income that they need to maintain their properties and to keep people housed. And we also need resources for homeless shelter and service providers to keep people who are experiencing homelessness safe and healthy and to get them housed as quickly as possible.
How concerned are you with the fact that we still don't even have a stimulus bill on the horizon? I mean, what you're calling for is among so many other issues that we're dealing with right now, and the call to action for people who are unemployed, for business owners. This is now another layer here. Is government intervention the only way at this point?
Well, there are things that can be done in the short term at the state and local level to try to make up for the lack of federal action. So we are urging governors and mayors, you know, not to wait for the federal government to act to protect renters in their state, in their city. Governors and mayors can reinstitute, re-implement, extend eviction moratoriums, statewide or citywide eviction moratoriums, like we had many of early in the pandemic. They can look for resources to put towards emergency rental assistance. And many have been doing that with some of the resources that are available. But the scale and the scope of this problem requires federal intervention and requires federal resources. And I will say that of those solutions that I named, at this point, they have passed the U.S. House of Representatives, not just once, not twice, but three times. There's practically unanimous Democratic support for these solutions in the House and in the Senate. And in those final days of negotiations before the election between Secretary Mnuchin and Speaker Pelosi, these solutions were on the table in the negotiations, and they weren't that far apart in the numbers or the specifics. What's required is coming to a deal on a larger package, and that's much more unclear and uncertain in terms of timing and possibility.
Stepping back a little bit, you know, I think when people hear about a housing crisis, they may immediately think about 2009 and 10 with all of those foreclosures. That was a different situation, but do you see any connection between now and then?
So, the best way to understand the eviction crisis that we face today, we really have to recognize where we were in our country even before COVID-19 came here. And that was in the midst of a severe affordable housing crisis, where we had a shortage of 7 million homes for the lowest income people. So another way of saying that same number is for every 10 of the lowest income people, there were fewer than 4 affordable apartments available to them. So because we had such a shortage, we had over 10 million of the lowest income people paying at least half of their income towards rent, and many were paying much more, 60, 70, 80% of their income on their home. So when you have such limited income to begin with, and you pay so much of it for the roof over your head, you're always one financial emergency away from missing rent, facing possible eviction, and in worst cases, becoming homeless. So for many of these same renters, the coronavirus and its financial fallout is that financial emergency, right? They've lost jobs, they've lost hours, they've lost wages, and it's harder than ever for them to cobble together what they need to make rent. And as you said early on, there were resources, there were protections put in place in those early months of the pandemic, but by and large, they've expired, they've been depleted, and the last remaining protection is set to expire on December 31st.
I want to ask you about something else. You know, this election cycle, we saw the Trump campaign invoke the building of affordable housing in suburbs as a means of scaring suburban voters about Black and brown people and poor people moving in. That was stoking racial and class tensions. But what do you think people need to know about the affordable housing crisis and the need for it?
Yeah, I mean, that was a very harmful and pretty transparent tactic of using fear and racism to try to drum up votes. I mean, we saw the president of the United States equating affordable homes with crime and declining property values, which couldn't be further from the truth. But unfortunately, in many communities, these are some pretty pervasive beliefs that show up in the form of NIMBYism. You can't build affordable housing in my backyard. And that NIMBYism and that kind of racist rhetoric from the president, it prevents much-needed homes from being built, homes that could be available to our lowest-income neighbors, seniors, people with disabilities on very limited fixed incomes, moms and dads working very low-wage jobs and childcare or healthcare essential jobs. And so federal governments at all levels have essential roles to play in ensuring that everybody in our community has a home that they can afford. And the president of the United States should be leading and championing those efforts, not denigrating them as Trump did.
Before I let you go, Diane, your name, as I mentioned, has been circulated to possibly lead the Department of Housing and Urban Development for the Biden-Harris administration. Would you take that role? And if so, what would be your first agenda items?
Well, it's certainly an honor to be considered. You know, look, in these next few months, we are facing one of the most severe housing crises in our country's history. Tens of millions of people on the verge of losing their homes in the next few months. And we have the solutions, but we need Congress to enact them, and we need leaders who can quickly and effectively implement them. So I'm focused, and we all need to be focused, on doing all that we can right now, in the coming months, in the coming years, to get and keep people housed, to work to repair the gaping holes in our social safety net so that we don't face this kind of crisis again during the next disaster or the next year. And we have so much work to do to end homelessness and achieve housing justice in our country, which is achievable. And this administration truly can be transformative to that work. So I'm looking forward to working with President-elect Biden and his team, whoever that may be, in whatever capacity that may be, to do just that.
That's Diane Yentl, CEO and president of the National Low Income Housing Coalition. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, so Thanksgiving. The huge surge in COVID-19 cases means large gatherings are out. You may know everything about your family, hence the word familiar. But if you haven't been quarantining with them for 2 weeks, you don't know the most important thing. Are they carrying the coronavirus? But resident chef Kathy Gunn says you can still make a festive meal. And Kathy, you've been hearing about how people are going to share this meal, even if they're not together. What are people doing?
Hi, Robin. All kinds of things. Some people I spoke to said, forget it. I'm canceling the holiday. I say no to that. Others tell me they're going to focus on a menu that has nothing to do with the traditional foods like turkey and stuffing. One friend's having lobster. Another one is making dumplings. I heard about another one is doing vegetable lasagna. And then there are these very creative ways to do it. Obviously, you can Zoom with loved ones, everyone at their own table in a different house in a different city. And then some friends told me they have family that's nearby, but they don't feel safe having them over, which is exactly the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. So they're each dropping off a dish. So I make the mashed potatoes, I drop them at your house, you make the turkey, you drop it at someone else's house, you sit down to eat separately on Zoom, but you're all experiencing the same food. It's a
that
stretch,
is so great.
But it might work. It might work.
Yeah, but you can still have the family recipes. But because people aren't doing these large gatherings, unless, you know, it's a home where everybody already lives together, apparently a lot of big turkeys are sitting on the shelves. I hope they go to food pantries. You say get a smaller one or use turkey parts. How would that work?
Exactly. So smaller birds apparently are in great demand right now, sort of 12 to 15 pounds. But I talked to a fellow food writer, excuse me, named Cynthia Graubart, who has written a book just about the pandemic and the holiday. And she offers a recipe for a skillet turkey thigh in sage mushroom gravy, where you slow cook the turkey thigh in a skillet. One thigh is huge, so it can serve two people. Or you can have two for four people. And honestly, you shouldn't have much of a larger crowd than that. And sage is such a perfect fall herb. Very simple, but really a delicious way to get a tender piece of turkey without dealing with the entire bird.
Mm-mm. And we'll have all the recipes at herenow.org. But of course, if you're not doing the full bird, you know, you can't cook stuffing in it, but you can still do stuffing anywhere, stovetop bake. But you have a recipe for a bread pudding. It sounds incredible. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so this is ultimate comfort food. This is sort of my version of how do you do a stuffing if you're not making the whole bird this year. This is a kale, mushroom, caramelized onion, and sharp cheddar cheese savory bread pudding. You use all kinds of leftover bread. You dry it out in the oven for a little bit, and then you saute your favorite mushrooms. You can use kale, Swiss chard, a lot of sharp cheddar cheese. This is so luscious. And I really think that you have to focus on how do I make this holiday special if I can't follow the traditions that I'm used to. And having one special dish that will, you light a candle, you put out a good, beautiful plate. Maybe it's just you. Maybe it's you and one other person. But something that signals a new tradition starting.
Well, and how about, you know, gratitude that you're there, you know, and not,
there's
you know,
that.
In the hospital. Right. How about that? And you say, you know, people are simplifying again, just because of the time we're in. And you have a roasted winter squash recipe.
Yeah, this is so simple that it almost sounds deceptively simple. You take a winter squash like a butternut, you peel it, then you cut it into half moon shapes, you throw it in the oven with a little bit of olive oil, salt and pepper, and then in the last 15 or 20 minutes of cooking, you put a little apple cider and maple syrup and ground ginger on it, and the syrup caramelizes. And it tastes like a very, very interesting, deeply flavored, deeply satisfying dish. Kids will love it because it's sweet. You know, I just wanted the meal to be simpler, and I want it to still ring with those flavors that we associate with this holiday. But maybe you don't need 5 different vegetables or 4 pies this year. We just have to scale it down in a way that makes sense.
So make less, maybe have... you know, cut in half the savory recipes. But what about the dessert?
Desserts are difficult. Most baked goods you can't just simply bake, cut in half. So normally, at least at my house, the Thanksgiving dessert table is a bit of an overkill. There's usually 2 pies. I'm going to make a cranberry cheesecake, but I would suggest just making 1 dessert. Definitely check out my recipe for cranberry sauce. Make a half portion. It's got orange and ginger and pineapple and pecans, because there are certain traditions that we don't want to let go of, and we don't need to. We just need to be smart and safe and make something delicious.
And by the way, in our next hour or another hour, we're going to be talking with Chef Ken Heydrich, whose new book is Pie Academy. And look, there you are in the back recommending it. So we'll be talking about pies as well today. But now, scaling down Thanksgiving with Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst. We'll have everything at hereandnow.org. Kathy, best wishes to you for the holiday.
And to you, Robin. Be well.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now.